Imperial Dragon.
Welcome to Smoking Section, a podcast by Eternal Dragons, a digital archive that emulates nicotine-filled rave break conversations to reflect on Asian diasporic identity, the arts, and culture. I'm your host, Miles, aka DJ Oyasumi. Today, we are joined by Ting Ting, aka Annie. She is a multidisciplinary designer, developer, and sometimes DJ working across digital, new media, and embodied technologies. Musically, she seeks to create soundscapes that highlight the work of marginalized artists, blending contemporary dance music with diasporic sounds and narratives. She is of Chinese ancestry and is grateful to reside as an uninvited settler in the unceded territories of Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations, colonially known as Vancouver, Canada. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Miles. Thank you for that introduction.
So I wanted to just start with you and maybe where you're from, where you grew up, what that was like, and maybe also kind of how you've thought about your identity over the years.
So I am, I guess, like what you would call a second generation immigrant. My parents were born in mainland China, specifically in the northwest Shanxi province, and they came over in 1990, and I was born a year later. At the time that my parents came over from mainland, it was actually closed to most mainland immigrants, so they came over as refugees. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that most of the Chinese people or Chinese, you know, ancestry people who were living in Vancouver at the time were from Hong Kong. For me, I grew up speaking Mandarin until I was about 5 years old. And at the same time, like meeting other Asians, we very rarely shared the same language. Mm. And so that always felt like quite isolating for me. And yeah. Very similarly reflected for my parents too. Luckily, my mom is like a polyglot, so she picked up Cantonese and I was able to pick up enough to get by, but it never really quite felt like I was part of anything here. Growing up, I grew up in like a pretty white, mainly white, smaller suburb of Vancouver. And I think that really impacted, I guess we can talk a little bit about my identity through this, is like that really impacted like how I viewed my identity being like oftentimes shared with a lot of people who've kind of immigrated with like parents mm-hmm. who are recently to like North America. So whether it be the States or Canada, there was a lot of bullying. There was a lot of harassment. There was a lot of like people thinking you were very weird or different mm-hmm. and like not very accepting. And so kind of gave me a very hard time with my identity growing up. And so for the longest time, I didn't really appreciate being Chinese. I just wanted to fit in. I just wanted to go to school with like the kids and just like not be seen as so different. Mm-hmm. For a very large portion of my life, especially because I grew up in a place with very few other Chinese people surrounding me, which is a little different from the rest of Vancouver because there actually is a very large Asian population in Vancouver. But because of my like language barrier and because of my location, I felt really disconnected from that. And so I never really had that kind of access. So grew up with like a lot of self-dislike or self-hate for being Chinese, wanting to be not Chinese, just to have an easier life.
Yeah.
And I think over the years, I've just, you know, I look back on how silly I was and how I could hate my culture for so long. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of really led me to really appreciate all the things that I grew up with and all the memories that I have of my parents sharing that culture with me, my memories of going back to visit my family in China, and also like becoming just very appreciative of my heritage in general, and also everybody else's stories that come along with, you know, there's so many stories. Everybody's is a little different.
Did you have much family or extended family in Canada at all, in Vancouver?
I didn't. It was just my dad, my mom, and I, and then eventually I had a little brother. After, I want to say, I turned 10, my half-sister, who was from my dad's first marriage, also came over, and so that was quite nice. But generally it was just a very like small, it was just my immediate family.
Yeah. And then what about going back to China? How often did you visit? Do you have any memories that you, like, looking back on it, appreciate or remember or stand out?
Totally. So I went back twice as a child, and that was it. I went back when I was 5, so I don't really remember that trip all that well. I remember meeting my family for the first time, which was really cool, and thinking I look like somebody else, which hadn't really happened to me before. I also went to a very cool amusement park that I kind of remember. It was honestly just really great to like meet my extended family. I had met, like, my dad has like a large extended family on his side with like 10 siblings and therefore numerous cousins and numerous like, you know, nieces and nephews and et cetera, et cetera. So that was really, really cool to see. My mom's side, it was really nice to meet them too. They're a little bit more tight-knit, which I also still really appreciate because we're still closer, I think, because of it. The second time I went back left a way stronger impression on me because I actually was, I think, 14 when I went back. And that was when I really just started really enjoying being there and, you know, held like a lot of memories of like the city and the places that I was hanging out in. And that really stuck with me. And that's, I think that was like a big turning point, was like thinking, oh, like, I really like being here. Like, being here is really comfortable, and trying to dig into that and like understand why it was that I felt more comfortable in a place that I didn't know than in the city that I grew up in.
Was there a sense of familiarity or like comfort or even like nostalgia when you were there like the second time?
Definitely. I think both times I went to both my parents' hometown, which is in Shanxi province, and just the smells, the accent, the dialect. It's quite similar to Mandarin, but the pronunciation is a little different, and it's pretty special and like dear to my heart. The way people speak there, that all came on and really made me feel like I was at home, just because of hearing like my parents having talked like that, the foods that they like to cook for us. Same with going back to Shanghai, where the rest of my mom's side lived. It was also really nice. It was really great to go back and be like, oh, even though the country has changed so much in the 10 years that I've been here, so I don't actually recognize anything, I still recognize like the vibe.
Yeah.
Like, you get in there and you can kind of just feel this hustle, bustle, but it's really hard to put it into words, but it's just, you land there and you feel at home.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. So I definitely felt that the second time, especially.
Did you feel like that was maybe a turning point in how you thought about and navigated your identity coming back to Vancouver?
I think so. I think the second time, especially, I think I was old enough to realize that there was nothing wrong with who I was and like my culture. And I learned to appreciate so much more of it. I think it was around the time I was like maybe middle school. So like, we have middle school here from like the ages of like 11 to 13. That was like when I started becoming like a little bit more okay with my identity. And I think right after middle school, I got to go and really cement that, oh yeah, I'm okay. I like being Chinese. Like, I'm fine with it. I like the food. Like, there's nothing to be ashamed of.
Yeah.
And people who are not for it, just boo.
True.
So.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
How has the trajectory kind of been, thinking about it and navigating identity since then?
I think the older that I get, the more that I learn and the more people I talk to and the more stories I hear and the more that comes out of kind of this like newer generation in Asia, it's all really inspiring and it makes me really proud. And I think that's like, that is like the vital difference between me in my 20s versus me in my like as a child, like a younger child, early teens, preteens, mm-hmm. child. For me, I think, you know, being exposed to a lot of people who do have pride in their culture. So my friend Sam running SHCR, Shanghai Community Radio, and just getting to see so much talent coming out of China, seeing, you know, labels like Subcults get huge and Genome get huge. I think it's all like kind of really fed into like this sense of like solidarity and pride. Mm-hmm. I think just like overall, like me moving to Vancouver, getting to meet more Asians, getting to make more like actual Asian friends and non-white friends overall outside of like my little suburban bubble really, really opened my eyes to a lot of that and helped me kind of develop those, my identity a little bit further. Now, even more so like with Eternal Dragons and Eastern Margins, I think it's really cool to see these collectives of people who are actually like really making like really great strides and like kind of getting like a global understanding of like Asians in the diaspora. And I think that's really helped overall too, just being able to, being exposed to so many different stories and so many different viewpoints and perspectives. It's been really eye-opening.
Mm-hmm. When would you say you were kind of starting to discover some of these different labels, radio shows, collectives? When was the kind of first time that you were starting to find those pockets?
Right before I went to university, I went and traveled through Europe. And that was when I discovered like the dance music scene for the first time, even though like Berlin, it was all in Berlin. So like very cliche and very like, you know, and very techno oriented. But it was something that I think I had been looking for a long time, because I never really quite felt understood or like accepted in a lot of the spaces that I was around in Vancouver at that time. That kind of got me into kind of electronic music more so. And I would say it would have probably been after university. So like like 6 years ago, maybe, that I kind of really started to take notice of all of these collectives and different labels starting to make focus on like Asians.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Like 2015, right?
Something like that. Yeah. I was like, frick, are we in 2021 already? I keep forgetting.
Yeah.
It's like COVID has totally made me lose track of like how long things happened.
I have absolutely no perception of time anymore.
Yeah. So I want to say it would have been like, because I graduated in 2013 and the first 2 years was kind of like, was like me moving out, getting working and living on my own and kind of starting to go out more and doing that kind of thing. And that's kind of when I started doing more of a deep dive into music.
Mm-hmm. You graduated college in 2013?
I did.
Mm-hmm.
Are you doing the math?
No, I'm not doing the math. I'm trying to imagine that time. Yeah, because I graduated college in 2017. So,
okay.
Yeah, because I remember, for me, I got into college radio when I first got to college, which was 2014, and one of my friends who was in radio, his brother runs the Astroplane.
Oh, I love Astroplane.
He'd been telling me about like club music, and I was really like just starting to get into just electronic music in general. So like all the deconstructed club stuff was like, this is crazy. Like it was maybe like too crazy for me, like at first. But then it wasn't until I think it was 2016, I went to study abroad in London. And I saw Nervous Horizons play, and I was watching like Akito's Boiler Room and like kind of getting into club music. And I feel like that time was really generative for the club music scene? Like I got into it at 2016, but maybe it was starting more around like 2013 or 2014.
I would say that like it was for me in 2013, it was less club music and more like electronic. At least in Vancouver, it was very much like a lot of like house and techno music, and there wasn't very much space for like experimental or deconstructed club music. I would say that I can't remember what year this was anymore, but I remember when Smile first started doing shows in Vancouver, that was one of the first times I had really heard the kind of music that I wanted to listen to, like played out in a space. I think that was when they brought Tove
yeah.
over.
I don't know how to pronounce, but yeah.
Her name is Tove, but I don't, Tokes, I think is how her producer name. And and I had just come back again from Shanghai and had met Sam for the first time, who had just started Shanghai Community Radio in Basement 6. And I had met Katie, and they were doing this like out of like this like very small cubicle of a room streaming radio, like pirate radio shows.
Yes.
And I heard the music that they were playing, and they were telling me all about some of these like really cool like producers working in China. And then I came back, and it just felt like this weird like amalgamation of like all of these things happening to like really like that fueled kind of this movement and this like very like deep interest, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was like, it was one of those things like when I heard deconstructed club and experimental club music, I was like, oh, this is what I've been looking for. If that makes sense. It was like, I've been looking for something and I didn't really quite know what it was, but like now that I heard it, it was like, this is what I've been looking for.
Right.
Yeah.
Curious about the Vancouver scene, music scene with electronic music, and kind of how you've seen it change. And I think also speaking to that in terms of how it compares and contrasts to how you can be exposed to like a lot of different things on the internet in terms of music. And yeah, just like how that compares and what you've noticed and how you've felt in the various like scenes or spaces in Vancouver.
Back in 2013, when I was kind of really getting into music, I didn't go out as much, but I did listen to a lot of more, I would say like more house music. That was during a time when like in Vancouver, Mood Hut was quite large, I would say. So like this Pacific Riviera,
right,
that got written about in RA and everything. So I think that scene was quite large and very prevalent, and also very white male dominated.
Yeah.
And just overall, like it just felt like a very white space. I didn't go to very many parties, to be honest. I didn't usually feel too comfortable doing that.
Yeah.
And that kind of that definitely carried over from like my experiences in Berlin, like really enjoying the music, but not really enjoying the people.
Yeah.
And feeling uncomfortable in the spaces, even though part of me felt comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
What was the second half of your question again? I totally forgot what I was talking.
That was a very long-winded question. Yeah, just sort of thinking about that in conjunction with the internet as a space for experiencing and being exposed to music. It kind of sounds like there was maybe like disconnect in terms of what was going on in Vancouver, how that felt to be in those spaces or to not be in those spaces versus the euphoria maybe of discovering music online.
Mm-hmm. I think discovering music online was a great outlet because it was like, oh, this is a sound that I'm looking for. But at the same time, like being so disconnected because you don't know anywhere that you can go find that sound.
Yeah.
Like near you. So there was definitely like a disconnection there. And I think that was like what made me so happy about going to Shanghai and then coming back to Vancouver and seeing Smile do their shows. And, you know, it had been there, but just like not within my, in my circle, within my, like, you know, my existence. So to learn that was really cool. Yeah, that time kind of feels like a weird blur in my mind right now. Just muddling through, trying to figure life out, and like kind of like almost like finding like a source of like light in a way.
But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that like my music tastes changed a lot during that time, because like back in high school, I loved, you know, I grew up listening to a lot of pop and R&B. What kind of stuff? Well, like, you know, like all the stuff that you would hear on MTV, all the stuff you would hear on, what was it, in Canada, we had like YTV, which was like a Canadian version of MTV, where they showed cartoons and did music countdowns.
Nice.
So, you know, there was a lot of the Spice Girls and Britney Spears and Destiny's Child and like NSYNC and Backstreet Boys when I was growing up. And then that kind of like, you know, that whole like the whole top 40s is like very large and prevalent in my early life. And then in high school, I did a total 180 and was like, I love metal music.
Oh, shit.
for a couple of years.
Dang.
I even joined a band as like a metal guitarist.
Oh, shit.
So, yeah, that was like also like a kind of like, you know, like a huge like identity change. And then just like also like that was also a very like white male dominated space that I didn't feel comfortable in. And so eventually just like kind of like that really like, I think, cinched the death of metal to me, like in my mind. Like I still do like metal music. Actually, I heard of a cool metal genre on the radio the other day called Bong Doom.
Wow.
It's like stoner doom metal, which is like so cool, and I actually really like it. And that was this guy on the university radio station.
Ooh.
plays like a show
with where's that scene base developing? What does that sound like?
It's like you know, like doom metal, so like a little bit like lo-fi metal.
Mm-hmm.
But like stoner doom metal is like a little bit more slowed down, like because like the stoners can't like keep up with like the faster metal pace.
That's so sick.
Yeah, it's actually really funny and I actually really like it. There was like a lot of like shifts as like my awareness kind of grew, and like I became like more aware of like my body in space, in these spaces, and what felt good and what didn't feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting how the people who listen to a genre of music can really dictate whether or not you want to listen to that genre of music.
Yeah. So many problems.
I know.
So many problems.
I know.
So many music scenes.
Yeah. I'm just like, I'm so appreciative of so much of that music, but I just couldn't be involved in it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. But do you feel like, I guess, not feeling comfortable in the physical spaces changed your engagement with or appreciation of like the art itself?
I think so. I think it starts taking up way less space. You start giving it less space, both in your like day and your mind. So spending less time like engaging with that sort of music, spending less time engaging with the people who are making that music.
Yeah.
Overall, it definitely changes, I think. But that's why the internet is great. So
yeah, for sure. There's just those pockets that you can find. And I guess it's like also maybe nice because the internet isn't always necessarily tied to a face, if you know what I mean. Like, in terms of, I mean, I guess like now Instagram dominates so much, although maybe it's like kind of dying out, but kind of like pre-Instagram, like pre-Facebook, like a lot of internet spaces, like forums and stuff, like you're kind of anonymous and it's just purely like your appreciation of music, which is not to say that somebody's politics or worldview might become apparent once they talk a bit more about like the music, like if the artist has like some sort of like political stance and then people on the forums are start like bashing on them and shit.
But yeah,
I feel like in a general sense there's something nice about the anonymity, and like it's a bit more pure in terms of like the love for the art, because it's not really like tied to necessarily like your being, and like mm-hmm. I guess being worried about like people judging you or something. Like you can really just find those pockets or create those pockets and find other like-minded people.
Yeah, totally. I think we met on SoundCloud first, I feel.
Yeah,
right. And before we became even internet friends, before I even knew your name, before I knew what you looked like.
Yeah,
yeah. So I think just specific to our relationship, I think it's interesting the way it developed,
mm-hmm.
because I think this is actually one of the first times we've had like a one-on-one conversation, like,
yeah,
in like this.
Yeah.
And there is like some sort of like very beautiful thing about how we met, and it was over like appreciation for something that was shared.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the more we learn about each other, the more we realize like, oh yeah, like cool, like you're into that too, hell yeah, that's
yeah,
sick.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't like grade my like friendships and relationships based on whether or not they're like IRL only or virtual only or whatever. There's just, you know, shared interests, there's shared experiences, there's shared going back to the internet. I think it was great because we got to meet.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really connected, I think, both of us to so many people who like we maybe wouldn't have access to in our own spaces.
Yeah, I have been thinking about that a lot recently. I made a couple of friends on the internet who live in the Bay Area, who are like Asian and kind of into the same art and stuff. And as conflicted as I feel about Instagram, there is a way that you can get to know people, or you can get to know that you have shared interests like quicker, as opposed to just randomly like meeting someone and then you have to be like, what do you like? What music do you like? What movies do you like? But you can just sort of like tell sometimes, or I don't know. It's kind of like a shortcut.
Totally. Totally. It's like somebody's stories are like, you know, a presentation of what they like. Right. So
yeah,
it's like, oh, cool. Like we vibe. That's sick. I definitely hear what you're saying, because so I've been taking like a hiatus of Instagram this year.
Yeah.
And I keep my like food, my food Finsta, which has very few like actual like friends that are on there. It's mostly just like foodies that like to cook and stuff.
Yes.
But on my main one, I just noticed myself, you know, getting to know people is a lot different now. I recently just also moved to a new neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also been kind of interesting. It's just very much like I have a dog, so I take him out all the time, and so I'm meeting all these people like IRL,
yeah,
and developing connections like slowly in that way is also has also reminded me of like just the delicacy, I think, of like building relationships and how it just you know, it's good to take time.
Yeah,
sometimes on Instagram I feel like it's a shortcut, and it's both a good thing and a bad thing.
Yeah I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I find I still really enjoy it though. Like I would say that even though it is a shortcut and maybe it makes it too easy, I also don't dislike it.
Yeah.
So maybe not so bad after all.
There's something so specific about like being a dog owner and getting to know other dog owners. I mean, I don't have a dog and I'm an outsider like looking in, but I can just imagine like you go to the dog park and you like your dogs interact and you like say hi, you like don't really know anything about them, and you just have like sort of like small pockets of like conversation. And yeah, there must be something nice about like that kind of slow, it's like a slow burn like friendship building.
Yeah, exactly. It was funny. So like I met this girl my first week having moved here. She's got really like really cute dog called Justin, mm-hmm. who just literally stops in his tracks every time he sees me and my dog because he wants to say hi to us. And it's freaking adorable. And just, you know, like at first, like we just say hi, but like, oh, how's your dog? Like we just talk about dog stuff. And then, and then like the next few times we see each other, we talk about, well, you know, how's your day going? Like, oh, like we talk about work a little bit. And, you know, it just like eventually cycles to a point where you feel like so much more comfortable with that person. And it's only through happenstance that we take our dogs outside to pee at the same time.
Yeah.
In a way. So I definitely wouldn't have made as many neighborhood acquaintances if I didn't have my dog, that's for sure.
I feel like, yeah, having a dog is a really good way to get to know people in your like immediate community that you wouldn't necessarily, there wouldn't be like an impetus for me to like talk to. I'm also really shy, but I wouldn't like just talk to a stranger if I go to the park.
Yeah, fair.
You know, like if you have a dog, like your dogs will interact and you'll just feel like, hey, like how's it going? And like
exactly, and exactly, just, they break the ice.
Yeah, and you like always go same time every day, and you know, there's just a familiarity. But yeah, it seems nice to be able to have different ways of connecting with people, and like sort of the fast internet connections and the like slower offline stranger dog interactions. And
at the same time, I feel like internet connections can also grow slowly.
That's true. That's true.
Which I really enjoy too. It's just like the more you see of a person, the more you want to engage with them.
You're right. I don't think a lot of my internet connection, like friendships, have been super fast actually.
It's definitely given me access to like communities that I wouldn't have had before.
Yeah.
You know, like I feel like even though I don't really know anybody in Eastern Margins very well, like I feel like so much more connected to like what is going on. Mm-hmm. In the UK because of it, just like just by like, you know, hearing of what they're talking about, or like following each other on SoundCloud, hearing the music that they're listening to, like it's pretty cool.
Yeah, there's something pretty cool about being able to connect with people through kind of shared interests, and for me it's like mostly by way of music and art. Through that, like you're getting to know different parts of the world, and like how people who have the same interests, their perspective on their environment and the different experiences that people have. But it's kind of cool, despite that, that I've been able to connect with people who seemingly would have like pretty different perspectives living in like different countries, and yet being able to find common ground. I guess I'm wondering, what has that experience been like in terms of connecting with other Asian folks throughout the diaspora? How has that been?
I think it's been interesting. I think even though you don't expect people to share the same points of view and perspectives just because they're from different places, it's crazy how many shared experiences that we can bond over. I can say one thing and every Asian around me will just be like, yep, you know, and they nod. And like, whether that be like here with friends who are Asian, or on the internet, we share memes that we understand. But like when the Chinese memes got really big, like was it a few years ago? Mm-hmm. That was sick. It was really cool to see like people have the same references.
Yeah.
I also was in, what was that group? Subtle Asian Traits for a little while. To bring up like a very controversial Facebook group. But I also have like a very big love for Facebook groups because I joined a few during the pandemic, and they just gave me good perspective, I think, through the whole thing, good motivation to keep doing things. I remember like, even though I didn't agree with a lot of what was being said on that, just as far as like having the same references was crazy. It was like, oh, yeah. This is like a group of people that shared a lot of the same experiences growing up. And what they did with it was very different from me, but it's cool to see that our lives all like have these serendipitous clashes and shared experiences. it kind of like feeds into this idea of like a collective memory for like a group of like diasporic Asians, which I really think is important. I think as a community, as like a global community, I think that there is very much so this idea and this actual physical like collective memory that we all share that can be accessed and kind of referenced.
Something that I've been thinking about, especially around April and around API Heritage Month, was, I don't know, Asian, maybe specifically like Asian Americans finding connection with each other through shared trauma. And on one hand, I think that that is really powerful and can be very cathartic and healing to be able to voice difficult experiences and be able to say, like, this happened to me. Like, has this happened to you? Like, am I crazy? You know, because like there's this whole thing of, did we actually experience racism, or like, was that actually harmful? And like, so much of, at least in America, there's so many like white Americans or just people in general kind of being like, well, it's not really that bad, or like the kind of like positive, like model minority, like compliments that aren't really compliments because they're harmful in a cultural systemic way. But I don't know. I think for me, I was thinking about it a lot during API Heritage Month, because if the basis of our connection is purely about shared trauma, and then we kind of find out that we have different values or just interests, I'm wondering if those relationships are maybe more tenuous and not as long lasting. This is getting pretty long winded, but I'm thinking kind of just about how I live in the Bay Area and there's a lot of Asian Americans, but the people that I've connected to the strongest have been you and like Varen and the whole like Vancouver crew and like friends in the UK and friends on the East Coast. But I don't know, there's something that I think I find powerful about the internet and like being able to find others and connect on stuff that is Asian, but it's also not just about racism. Yeah, I don't know. It's just something that I was thinking about a lot during API Heritage Month, because I was like, representation this, representation that, but I'm not vibing with this representation. And that's what I think to me feels powerful about collectives like Eastern Margins and Eternal Dragons, and that we're coming together kind of first through a shared appreciation for a specific niche of like art. And then we're finding these other commonalities, like these other experiences and things that we're proud of, like food or different movies and stuff like that.
I guess like one thing that I was thinking about a lot this past year, especially I think with Asian Americans and Asian Canadians, this idea of like Asian rage and the whole culture that's kind of culminated from calling out like the Mahjong Karens and Kanji Karens and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, even though I can understand where it comes from, I can't really relate to that reaction that other Asian Americans and Asian Canadians are having. So I think that has been like, that has definitely challenged, I think, my, not necessarily solidarity, but definitely like the kinds of relationships within the Asian communities that I do want to have. And I totally hear you when you say like Eastern Margins, Eternal Dragons all came together because of this shared love. And not only that, but we all connect with each other better because we also share a lot of the same values and share a lot of the same morals and share a lot of the same, you know, and it kind of feeds off from there, because I feel like even just liking the same things is never enough. I think like a way of living or like an idea on how to live, I think, is most important.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I appreciate about these collectives, is they reflect a lot of my values outwards to to other communities. And I think, and that's like, that that is what makes you like more proud, right? That of being part of it.
That's a, feels like a good place to pivot towards the mix that you did for us
for
the radio.
That's right.
Yeah, I just would love to get to know your process and making it. And you told me about it a little bit over text of kind of what you were thinking about, but I'd love to know how you found the tracks and the ideas that were going through your head when you put it together.
So when I was doing radio, for a now defunct radio station, I focused on kind of bringing together music from the general Asian diaspora, not necessarily even just Chinese. I felt like there wasn't very much a space for that in Vancouver. And so I started during that time to like kind of set up like ways of looking for music. So following like labels that do that showcase like Asian artists through like SoundCloud, through Bandcamp. I used less YouTube than I would like. I feel like there's a lot more gold on YouTube that I haven't found, but I find the algorithm really gets in my way. So a lot of it is kind of music that I've been listening to. A lot of it is music that's released by people that I follow and enjoy and like think that there's value behind. Some of it is like more throwback nostalgia. So a lot of the music was already in my library when I did that mix, which I really like, kind of like working with tracks that have sat but haven't been played out before. I always feel like doing mixes, especially for internet radio, there is a lot more room to stretch out than just DJing live. There's room to kind of to show more of a narrative for it. I made that mix at the end of 2020, right. So it would have been December. I guess like the whole month I had been thinking about it and just like kind of collecting my thoughts on what kind of vibe I wanted to go for. And then I think I told you the night before I literally changed everything and re-recorded it the next morning and then sent you my first take. Yeah, it was kind of like in a weird, like right before Christmas, in isolation, depression, anxiety spiral. Thinking, you know, like what has this year been? Like a lot of like really sad things have happened both like globally and in my personal life. And but making it was very cathartic. I had been feeling very hopeless. And then to be honest, I hadn't really been focusing on music very much prior to our conversation about it and prior to doing the mix, because it just wasn't, there wasn't very much that was making me feel happy or good. So overall, like my like initial feeling was like I was feeling very like hopeless and despondent and just kind of spiraling and sad. And so I think a lot of the beginning of the mix kind of reflects of a little bit of that. Also feeling a little nostalgic for like times past.
Yeah, like if the Britney edit.
Yes. Exactly. I always turn to that, actually, that the original when I'm sad.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, always. So I thought Caro did a really great job of like kind of reinterpreting that sensation.
It's so beautiful. It's so good. Yeah.
at the same time, you know, there are parts of me that are very sad and hopeless. And then there are parts of me that know that this is just how I'm feeling in the moment and that things will pass. And I just, you know, you have to keep pushing and things will get better eventually. But it wouldn't change unless you do something about it, right? So for me, like, despite feeling hopeless, I can also feel hopeful at the same time, and holding that contradiction in me. What, you know, the club scene has always been, has been like a very much like an escape from the day to day, kind of a place where you can be free. And it brings me a lot of hope, because I see a lot of, I think, beautiful things happen in the scene that I wish could be replicated more in our day-to-day lives. I guess I was just trying to kind of reflect that contradiction of like both hopelessness and hopefulness together, and hoping to bring it to like a point where I felt like, yes, you can feel this way, but look, like there's energy here. There's there, you can have movement at the same time, and to kind of go on. And then I was also at the same time, like, having played a lot of video games during the pandemic and had played Dark Souls for the first time.
Yeah.
I didn't really realize like how much lore there was in Dark Souls. And for me, I think video games with a lot of lore and story and context there, it's especially beautiful because it's engaging in like a kind of world building in a very like tangible way to share with other people. And I was thinking about the sequel to it, and just how everything in that world just gets worse no matter how hard you fight in the first. And it's just, you know, and I think that like really cemented, like, you know, the character you play in Dark Souls is fighting still, like fighting to like either get out or do something different or make it better, or just like to escape, you know, in such a hopeless, like, terrible place.
Oh my God.
And he's only going to fight to get to an even more terrible place, but he's going to keep fighting because, you know, there is some sort of light at the end of the tunnel, hopefully.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I wanted to leave it on, was like, you know, like, we're probably not over any of the calamitous things that have happened in our world this year. And it's probably going to go on for a very long time. And it will probably get worse before it gets better, which I feel like it is sort of, you know, with all the, like, especially with all the climate disasters that have been happening this year, the Delta variant, this Delta Plus variant, or whatever they're calling it.
New drop.
And, you know, it's a good reminder for me not to give up. And if it even makes one person feel even close to that, or if they even just enjoyed it, that's enough for me. For me, making mixes and listening to music has always been like super personal and like a deeply personal thing, more so, where I would never put out anything that I wouldn't go back and listen to myself.
Yeah, I remember just the timing of it, everything that was happening in the world. I don't even remember what was happening in the world, but I remember feeling really uplifted by the mix. And I think that's because I'm always like such a sucker for like euphoria in electronic music. And it starts off like really slow and very beautiful and very euphoric. And I love like how I remember how long it is before the more dancey stuff comes in. And I love that a lot, because I think a lot of times, you know, people like use one track that's like sort of beatless, whatever, and then they like get into it, or they just dive into it. And I appreciate like that endlessness is something that I really like in electronic music. And actually what first drew me to Eternal Dragons was the mix for The Fader, where Justin had the K-pop trance edits. That was the first time like really that I think I had heard trance music in a not corny, like sandstorm way.
Exactly. It's like you hear trance music and most people are turned off, but you're like, actually, trance music is great if it's done right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I just remember that mix gave me a lot of hope. Yeah, it was really good. Yeah, and I also feel like a point that I think I'm trying to get across, or that we're hoping to get across through getting to talk to people about the mixes, it really feels like everybody who's done a mix really brings their A game to it. And maybe I'm just projecting because like I've done mixes, but it feels like there's a certain level of like care and intention, maybe because of what Eternal Dragons is, but maybe also because of the artists that we're reaching out to, but maybe just a combination of what this collective is and can be, and creating that space and inviting people into that space. I don't know. I'm just always like, every mix is so good. And so, yeah, it was really cool to hear everything that you were thinking about in terms of putting it together.
The mixes that I've done before, I feel, you know, you always care about them when you put them out and you always put in a lot of effort into them. But this one felt a little bit more intentional, at least in like, at least kind of the amount of time I spent thinking about it and the ideas I was hoping to convey, the feelings that I was hoping to convey. I think there was definitely a lot more. I definitely did put in a lot more time and thought behind the intention of the mix versus a lot of the ones that I do for others solely because it was Eternal Dragons, because it was you reaching out, because I'm a big fan of everything that Eternal Dragons does and stands for. So yeah, I think there's definitely some truth to what you're saying.
Well, I'm glad I'm not just projecting. Yeah, but I got that impression from talking to Varen about the mix that they did for Eternal Dragons a while ago.
Which, I love that mix.
Yeah, it's my
the best one.
Top five, definitely in top five. I think it's my favorite mix ever.
Maybe, I think so too. Nice. I was like, it's like, it just like, it is so, it really echoes what it's like growing up in the West as an Asian.
Yeah.
Like fully. And in such a unique and like special way.
Yeah.
You know, it's like not, it's not cliche, and it's coming out in like so many different
exactly. Yeah. It's like so sprawling in terms of like all the different eras, aesthetics, like scenes, whatever.
Yeah. For me, the one that really stood out was Miles's GGG cover on the drums.
Yeah.
I love that one.
I love how freaking distorted it is.
Yes. Did you see the original YouTube video?
No, I have. Can you, is it still up?
I don't know. I haven't looked for it for a while now, but if I find it, I'll send it to you.
Okay, great. Great. I wanted to pivot. It would be remiss if we didn't talk about food. And you mentioned your food Finsta, but yeah, I'd love to know when you started it and yeah, just like your relationship to food, like why you started a food Instagram and kind of, cause I also have a food Instagram. So I know there's like this like fun little community of people who are just like at home, like amateur like cooks, and it's really goofy and it's really wholesome. And yeah, I'm wondering how you started that and just overall like your relationship with food and cooking, and maybe also tying into like identity.
So let's see, I'm looking back and my first post on my food blog was February 4th, 2019. And I had been posting pictures of food on my original Instagram stories for like probably at least a year before that. Mm-hmm. And I guess I just felt like I just wanted a space where it didn't feel weird to just post pictures of things that I eat and things that I make. even though I'm not super, super active, for me, food has always been about kind of sharing and being with others. I remember growing up, my parents both worked a lot. So we didn't get to eat together very often, but whenever we had the chance, we would eat together and it would be a special time. You know, both my parents were like immigrants, worked 12-hour days, often probably more, 14, 16 hours. So my brother and I fended for ourselves most of our lives, but my mother always took the time to cook us dinner before she went to work in the evening. It was interesting because I think growing up, I didn't appreciate, I think going back to like my identity and how difficult it was being Chinese in like an all-white space and not really understanding the value of it at that time. Mm-hmm. I think for a portion of my life, a lot of that was, oh, like Chinese food, I just want to eat spaghetti or something, or lasagna. I love lasagna. I still do. But now I look back on the foods that my parents made for me with a lot of fondness. They very much serve as like points of nostalgia for me. So when I look at a dish, I can remember like the places mm-hmm. that I ate it, the people that I ate it with, the feeling that I had. Actually, so for your birthday, when you had your virtual potluck, I made my dad's lamb stew.
Yeah.
Which is like a very popular dish from his hometown. So I had eaten it there before. I'd eaten it at home before. I had eaten it at restaurants in Vancouver before. But that was the first time I had made it at home. And it was interesting because when I think about that dish, I always think about the feeling that it gives me and like the memories that it gives me. I always remember like my mom would always make these like chive hand dumplings to go with that stew because she didn't really like to eat too much meat. So she wanted to have some veggies on the side.
Yeah.
So she would spend all day like yelling at us to help her knead dough and stuff like that. And we'd just be like in and out of the kitchen covered in flour. My dad would make the bread that comes with it that you have to tear into little pieces. He would take them right off the stove. And I remember always burning my fingers trying to tear them apart because like we wanted to eat and we were hungry because we'd been waiting hours for this dish. Chaotic, very like familiar at the same time. I think of the time I went to Xi'an for the first time and had it there. And I remember like doing that same motion in the restaurant. And so all of it becomes like tied into this like interesting cloud of memories. So for me, like dishes, especially like special dishes like that, like really echo that sentiment of being with other people and like specifically like maybe certain people as well. I wanted to document the food because, well, first of all, it's so pretty. And I love looking at it, but also because like it's a good reminder of like who I got to spend that time with. Being on that food Instagram, especially with some of the people we follow, has really taught me so much about Asian food that I'm not aware of, both on the food Instagram and also on the subtle Asian cooking Facebook group that I'm in. There's a lot of knowledge out there that everybody has to share, and I'm grateful to be on the receiving end of that knowledge and hope that I can contribute a little bit once in a while.
Yeah.
And otherwise I just feel like that space is extremely like heartwarming, and maybe it's corny, but it's just really sweet and really nice. I think we all could use more nice, welcoming, open spaces in our lives.
True that.
But your food Instagram has really blown up. You're so active.
Oh my god.
All this shit posting.
I'm surprised how many followers I have. It's because I just follow a lot of people, I think, and then they follow me back. But I don't feel like my food is particularly like that's why I zoom in on everything, because it's like the plating's not really that good. But yeah, it's just been a really fun space. And I think for me, I've been kind of using it as a journal, but through the vantage point of food. And yeah, like you were saying, the memories that foods can evoke. I feel like sometimes I have a hard time accessing memories. So certain mediums like music, but especially food, have this way of triggering and like activating those memories. That's really special. And then it's also just really pleasurable because it tastes really good. And then you have this like wash of emotion and like memory coming back to you. There's something special about the like sensory experience that is tied to memory and how you can time travel in a way.
for me, the smell gets me right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, the smell and like the sounds of cooking, I find like very nostalgic as well as soothing. No matter where I am, even though my mom hasn't cooked for me in like years, I still know the sound of her cooking in the wok. It's yeah. very specific, you know, so there's something really beautiful about, you know, communing together over something and then sharing that and like being able to go back to that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the thought of your food Instagram as a journal though. And yeah. I really see that because you post very regularly and you always have captions about like what it's about. And I love the zoom in aesthetic. So
thank you. Yeah, it's been really fulfilling. I feel comfortable being able to have really like long captions that are talking through food.
Mm-hmm.
It's very cathartic. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. I feel that.
Yeah.
I also feel like, you know, like you show love through food as well.
Totally.
And that's another aspect of it. It's like, I love to cook for the people in my life. That's another way of like connecting and community.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially like the way that dish that your dad made and then like your mom made the pancakes, all the labor that goes into it. Food is nourishment. Like we need food to live, but it's also tastes really good. Like when that care is put there, and I totally vibe with food as a love language for sure.
Hell yeah. Same.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Where can our listeners find you on the internet out in the world?
So my food Insta is my favorite thing ever. And it's called Blessed Spam. So it's at blessed.spam. I go by Ting Ting on SoundCloud. So that's T1NG. And I'll be back on Instagram one day.
Someday. No rush.
I'm not rushing. I'm not ready yet. I'm enjoying my hiatus.
Definitely.
A lot. Yeah. And thank you, Miles, specifically, and also to Eternal Dragons for, you know, building a really beautiful community, creating all of this body of work and putting in all of that time and labor and thought and intention. So thank you for all of that.
Thank you.
It's been very special.